No, 3 o'clock. Yeah. They come in here.
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Committee on Business and Labor to order. And we're going to start off by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2907. And up first, we'll have Senator Gelser and Tony Lapez.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that provides that the specialized building inspector can be appointed by a municipality to administer and enforce parts of the specialty code, and it allows certification of appointed building inspectors to perform inspections in the building code administration regions.
Thank you. Welcome. And if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Bynum, and members of the committee. For your record, my name is Sarah Gelser, and I'm the state senator from Senate District 8 that includes Corvallis and Albany, Philomath, and the surrounding areas. I'm happy to bring, along with Representative Rayfield today, House Bill 2907. We both learned about this issue last year when we were approached by a local company, the Clare Company, about a change in statute that pretty significantly impacted their status as an organization that contracts with local municipalities to do specialized building inspections. This is an important business in our community and has been very important to our local jurisdictions, who have indicated that there is a limited availability of certified inspectors. So we are simply asking that our community be able to continue doing work in the way that it has been done in the past, and that we eliminate what I believe was an unintentional error in the statute previously. So I would commend to you Senate Bill 2907. We've got others that can speak to you with more specificity moving forward, but our local jurisdictions are also very supportive of this measure.
Great.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and Vice Chair Bynum and members of the committee. I'm here representing Representative Rayfield's office, and we would also like to just second everything that the senator has said and advocate that we make this change to allow work product for construction being able to be kept on schedule around the state, and especially within our district.
Go Beavs.
Oh, wow. The opposition just grew exponentially. So any questions for the senator or Tony? Thank you very much for starting us out on this one. I appreciate your testimony, and we'll definitely be listening to a few people on this subject matter.
Thank you. And with your permission, I'm going back to the committee that I'm chairing right now, if that's okay.
Senator, you never need my permission. So with that, I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2907, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3146.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure that specifies that the wage requirements for workers who are hired for businesses that benefit from certain economic development programs must be determined with respect to the permanent positions. It takes effect 91 days following adjournment signing day.
Thank you, and we'll have Representative Smith join us.
Thank
Welcome
you.
To the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Oregon State Representative Greg Smith. Colleagues, I have the distinct pleasure of representing District 57, which includes the Port of Morrow, Port of Umatilla, Port of Arlington, Biggs Junction, and the Port of the Dalles, Umatilla County, Morrow County, Gillam County, Sherman County, and the very, very best parts of Wasco County. Mr. Chair, thank you for letting me be here. Colleagues, House Bill 3146 is being brought to you at the request of the Port of Morrow, who has found themselves the victim of great success. And before I start off, I want to thank Business Oregon and our folks at the Building Trades for working with us to bring a bill forward that I believe and I hope you'll see has broad consensus and will allow the Port of Morrow to continue moving forward in its aggressive desire to create family wage jobs for all of Eastern Oregon. As background, Morrow County is home to the Port of Morrow. The Port of Morrow has managed to successfully recruit businesses with the use of their Enterprise Zone program. As a program requirement, locating companies must pay 150% of the county annual average wage for new jobs. 150%. We're cool with that. But there's a problem, and I'll get to that in a moment. The calculation, however, of county annual average wage includes both temporary construction jobs and permanent jobs. It also does not take into consideration where the employees live. And if you know where the Port of Morrow is located, it's right where Interstate 82, 84, the Union Pacific Mainline, and the Columbia River come together. And it's just a short hop for folks over the river into Kennewick, Richland, and Pasco, better known as the Tri-Cities. For example, recent projects at the Port of Morrow, such as data centers, has seen temporary construction jobs paying 80,000 plus salaries, but the workers live in the Tri-Cities, just 25 miles up the interstate. Mm-hmm. Again, we think this is great that these construction workers are making these wages. We don't want to discourage that. But these salaries are artificially increasing the county's annual average wage, even though they're temporary jobs. And so what this has done is it's made the Port of Morrow ineligible for enterprise zone allowance. And so what we're offering with House Bill 3146 is a solution to issue or to address this issue. It would only count permanent job salaries towards the county's annual average wage only in rural Oregon. Okay, and that's important because what we want to be able to do is allow our food processing companies and those other companies that pay good family wages but not $80,000-$90,000 a year to still be eligible for the enterprise zone. And so what this bill does is it says the port would continue to be eligible for the enterprise zone, and it would allow for all rural counties to be eligible for this program. So we hope it's a simple bill. We originally brought this forward, and it was completely my fault without talking to the building trades. The building trades came and visited with us. We've worked through the amendment that we would like to bring forward that would allow this bill to only apply to rural counties. And we think we've found a good solution. So.
Thank you. And go ahead. Introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, Chair Holfe. My name is Lisa Middlestorf, and I'm the Economic Development Director at the Port of Morrow. Members of the committee, thank you very much for hearing from us today. If you don't know much about the port, we've been very successful in a lot of growth in the last 10 years. Essentially, hundreds of construction jobs come to our county every year, but as Representative Smith said, those wages are often very high, especially when there's a short term getting a construction project done. The wages tended to jump higher into that $90,000 range. Companies like Lamb Weston, for instance, who built a $300 million investment in a new French fry plant in the port, it increased the amount that they would have to pay to qualify for the enterprise zone. So companies like that they're hurting themselves sometimes because they're constructing a huge project and bringing in construction wages, which are really great for all of the visitor industry in our community. It doesn't help them when they're trying to meet that 150% wage level for the enterprise zone. So this is a fix that we think will be a benefit to everyone, and it's just helping us get started on our continued growth.
Mr. Chair, if I could just add one last point. It's really important to understand part of the mission of the Port of Morrow, and that is to create good family wage jobs. And so the port makes it a high priority as they're working with these companies to talk to them about how can we get the highest possible wage with benefits. And without this legislation, it's really going to make it difficult for the port to continue on that path. We think it's a great win for the state, and it's a great win for business. It's a great win for Morrow County.
Question from Representative Doherty.
First of all, twice a year I drive by the Port of Morrow, and it has expanded tremendously, so I congratulate you on that. But I have a question about the language in the bill, because it goes through and refers to the new language, you know, to get the it would be on line 20 on the first page, 20 and 21, and it goes, as determined at the time of authorization with respect to permanent positions located within the county. And not that employers aren't always, you know, great players, but does this leave people a loophole to go through and just hire part-time people to try to manipulate wages or not? Or am I just getting a little paranoid?
The 150%.
You don't have to answer that, Representative Smith.
Oh, I would like.
The 150% level is on full-time wages.
Okay.
So the only hiccup is the fact that we've brought in hundreds of higher wage construction jobs that forces the businesses that are there permanently to increase, you know, $15,000 a year more than they had mm-hmm. intended to. The wages in Morrow County are incredible now, and we have a lot to thank due to the Enterprise Zone for that, because of that 150% just driven the wages up and up and up.
So you don't see it as an issue that all of a sudden people would?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
No.
So let me be really clear. I haven't done a good job of clarifying what this bill does. Effectively, what this legislation does is it looks at family wages within rural Oregon. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it says we are going to take out of that calculation the construction jobs. Okay?
That are temporary construction jobs.
Correct.
As opposed to a construction company.
Correct.
That works
only
all over.
For rural Oregon. We're going to take them out of the calculation, and then you have to be at 150%
okay.
of family wage. So if you're willing to create 150% of family wage mm-hmm. without the inclusion of these temporary construction jobs, then you're eligible.
Okay.
And the reason we're having to do that is these temporary construction jobs are just shooting the average through the roof, and it's making companies like Lamb Weston ineligible, even though they're creating good family wage jobs.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
And just a point of clarification, and we can, you know, get further answers offline. So listening to this, I'm guessing you're considering all construction jobs to be temporary, because the nature of a contract is usually doesn't last more than a year.
Correct.
And so that's what your concern is. It isn't really whether or not they're from Tri-Cities or from
no.
Bend, really.
No, no.
It is that construction jobs come in for 3 months and then they're gone.
Correct.
To somewhere else.
Correct. But here's the point on this, Mr. Chair. These construction folks have done a great boom for the economy. It mm-hmm. has been great. The dilemma is because their incomes are so high, it's mm-hmm. throwing off that average and making it difficult for the Port of Morrow to attract other folks through the Enterprise Zone. Companies, primarily your food processing companies, the data companies are throwing off the opportunity for other companies who want to come in.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing it forward, and we'll have some more conversations about it and see how we do.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, there's no one else signed up. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3146. And we'll go back and reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2907. And up next, we will have Aaron Doyle, Doris Pinwell, and Royal Mortier. Good afternoon. Just identify yourself and let's get started.
Good afternoon. My name is Royal Mortier, and I'm the current COO of Mortier Engineering in Eugene, Oregon. Prior to joining Mortier Engineering in 2014, I worked in construction, inspection, and design for both public and private entities across the U.S. I hold a degree in building inspection technology from Chemeketa Community College and civil engineering from Oregon State. Go Beavs.
You didn't catch the opening, did you? Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm making friends already. I also carry multiple building code certifications and am licensed as an engineer in multiple states. I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 2907. Mortier Engineering and its subsidiaries has provided private party code services to jurisdictions in need since 1973. As the grandson of the founder, and son of one of the long-term inspectors and building officials, I've seen firsthand the extensive training and continuing education these inspectors go through. I've also seen the disproportionate regulation imposed by the state against private party providers. House Bill 2907 aims to undo one such regulation, restricting the earning and use of the specialized inspector certification. The specialized inspector program was developed as a middle ground to expand on an inspector's abilities for review of plumbing and electrical through training versus having been in the trades. The basis of knowledge necessary and training received is not different whether the inspector works for a public entity or a private company. Therefore, it does not make sense to allow a regulation that would impose such a bias. Such a bias would not stand if it was based on gender, race, or physical abilities, and it should not stand against an individual, regardless of public or private employee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doris Penwell. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2907. The association and its member counties have had a long history with the difficulties of maintaining building inspection services on behalf of their county and the work that's going on there. They particularly have trouble in a smaller populated county being able to hire somebody and keep them on staff for enough of the services that are needed when they're needed. So they've had lots of history with having to go to other counties to find somebody to come in and do the inspection service or wait several weeks to get somebody there to do the job. This bill allows for one further step in order to allow the county to have on contract someone that can do the services for them when they need them. Now, we understand that it's important that the state and the county have adequate supervision over what it is that we require them to do. So I would say that AOC and its counties feel some responsibility toward making sure that the services that are provided are adequate and within the law of the building codes. And we're glad to work with anybody if there are some issues that are raised that need to be handled with this bill. But I think that we are moving ahead in the process of being able to provide efficient services for the building that's going on. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities, also in support of House Bill 2907. The first thing I would do is commend the committee's attention to the number of cities that weighed in on this issue on OLIS, represent cities of varying sizes and geographic location. The key consideration for us in this concept is that some days we need a little bit of help and we want to be able to contract for it because we can't always have a public employee on call ready to do this, especially in some of our cities that are seeing, you know, really rapid rates of growth. And if we're looking to find ways to expedite the process, to make sure that inspections are happening on a timely basis, having the ability to contract out for some of those services to meet these specialized inspections and ensuring that they're done by certified, well-trained, maintaining education types of inspectors, we need to return to that flexibility to contract out for this when we need, when necessary. It's also important for some of our smaller jurisdictions that might not have sufficient work for a full-time employee, but want to have the advantage of having a local inspection program so that local builders and local trades have the opportunity to have a more rapid response than waiting for someone to come from a farther away jurisdiction. If the city wants to create that program locally and contract out for those services, it helps increase the rapid response to have a contract with a company like the Clare Company or others that work throughout the state. And for those reasons, the other thing I'd like to say is that there are still all of the restrictions that are placed on a local government in adapting or adopting a local inspection program exist on the city. We still have to play by the same rules related to how we spend our fees, how we do our oversight that we would if they were internal versus external, and we can't violate the statutes just because we contract out, and we would hope that no one is doing that. I'm happy to answer any questions about this issue and hope you will support us.
We have a lot of people to testify today, but I do have a quick question. I can totally understand the need for, you know, contracting out for inspection services, but when I read this bill, it also talks about actually administering and being responsible for enforcing the code. So it sounds like you're contracting out the whole building department and all the decision making and authority that goes with it. So I'm kind of curious about that language.
Actually, that's some jurisdictions do request full services, and there is a process to fully assume a jurisdiction's program. However, in most cases, we private parties do not assume the entire program. They provide overflow support. One such example would be Josephine County. Josephine County, their maximum, the highest level inspector they have is somebody with the SEI, the Specialized Electrical Inspection. However, they are an area that is getting a lot of grow operations, and the size of these grow operations exceeds the limits of that are permitted under the SEI license, and therefore they need a full A-level electrical inspector.
I understand the inspector piece. It's administering and having the full authority of the local government by contracting it out.
I'd like to respond to that. I understand your question. It is very important, no matter what the job is, that you're contracting out from a governmental agency. You have to maintain supervision over that contract. Otherwise, it's almost illegal. So you can't just give it away and assume they're doing the job of the government. So I think that's why I said I think we are obligated as cities, counties, any government to make sure we maintain that appropriate supervision.
And it just wasn't clear to me in the bill. So
yeah, thank you.
I appreciate your testimony today. So up next, Millie Hicks, Alan Clare, and David Flemings. Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record and try to keep your testimony concise so we can get through our agenda, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, and members of the committee. Thank you so much for taking the time to hear us today. My name is Millie Hicks, and I'm president of Clare Company Incorporated, a spawn business in Corvallis, Oregon. Here with me today are Alan Clare, our founder, and Dave Flemings, one of our vice presidents. We're here today to provide testimony in support of House Bill 2907 to explain how the state statute poses an unfair advantage and why House Bill 2907 is important to the success of our small business. We think it's equally important to the success of the jurisdictions throughout Oregon. We want to thank our local legislators, Representative Rayfield and Senator Gelser, for their time and work on this issue and for sponsoring this bill for us. We also want to recognize all the communities from around the state, large and small, who are providing their strong support of this bill, as evidence on record. Clare Company is a small business, and so we support 30 families from Corvallis to the Portland metro area and over to Hood River. We provide professional building code services throughout the state with certified and highly qualified staff. Under the current statute, our certified staff are unable to provide specialized plumbing and electrical inspection services for our clients, even though we hold the same certifications as those jurisdictional employees. This limitation is based solely on the fact that our inspectors are not employed directly by a municipality or the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We believe the current statute sets an unfair double standard. The simple language change that we propose under House Bill 2907 will correct this, making the change to include properly certified inspectors who are appointed by a municipality.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Bynum and the committee members. My name is Alan Clare, and I'm a resident of Corvallis, Oregon. I'm here to speak in support of House Bill 2907. I'm the founder of Clare Company, which is located in Corvallis, Oregon. Clare is a licensed building inspection and plan review provider under ORS 455-457, which was incorporated in Oregon in 1990. Currently, Clare provides building official, building inspection, plan review services for more than 19 jurisdictions in the state of Oregon. I began my career in building inspection in Oregon in 1977. Over the past 40 years, I've provided those services as a public employee for approximately 20 years and a private sector employee for approximately 20 years. I specifically changed my employment from the public sector managing city development services to provide private sector to the private sector so that I could focus solely on better construction project delivery in the area of code compliance without the needed attention to other city administration duties. When I made my change to the private sector as a certified building official, inspector, and plans examiner, I was selected by the state to chair the committee to assist the state in writing the administrative rules and that govern the practices of licensed building inspection and plan review providers to ensure that appropriate state oversight would be provided. I have great respect for the ethics of public safety, the certification and training rules for certified building inspectors, and the ongoing need for excellence in this technical profession. Clare has been fortunate enough to provide certified building official inspection and plan review services throughout Oregon, Washington, California, and New York for some of the most challenging and complex building construction projects on record. As you may be aware, Oregon faces a shortage of certified building inspectors. In 2013, the legislature passed a change to ORS 455-715 and the definition of specialized building inspector. These changes have limited the availability of certified inspectors, particularly for smaller cities and counties. The current statute arbitrarily sets a double standard for individuals employed by a jurisdiction to those providing identical services to a local government through a contract. Clare has joined with our government jurisdictional partners and other state licensed building inspection and plan review providers to ensure that this double standard is corrected. A simple language change to the definition of specialized building inspector in ORS 455-715 fixes the issue. The proposed language allows jurisdictions to contract with properly licensed and certified inspectors and companies to act as specialized building inspectors. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Dave Flemings. I'm a resident of Corvallis, Oregon. I'm here to also speak in support of House Bill 2907. It typically takes 3 to 4 full-time staff to cover all the disciplines required in the building department based on certification requirements on it. A lot of small jurisdictions cannot handle, they don't have workload and they don't have budgets to cover 4 full-time staff on it. So that's where we get into the requirements for specialized inspectors on it. Larger jurisdictions also use those inspectors, companies like ours, to cover spikes in workload and staff shortages. Currently, the state issues specialized building inspector certifications in both plumbing and electrical. These certifications provide for less technical inspection for light commercial services and can often be accomplished by a building inspector that's already on site if he's properly certified on it. And we don't have the requirement to send another inspector to the field and pay for additional staff at that point. There are currently a major shortfall of all of our A-level certified folks in the state. That's why it's so important to have these services available to our communities. We've met with parties who have expressed concern over third-party services like Clare Company. These concerns range from consistency of code calls to permit fees to funding of inspection services. Our inspectors hold the same certifications and are held to the same standards as all other inspectors in the state, and we follow the BCD direction just as any other jurisdiction is required to. We're also subject to even more regulation as a third party because we have additional certification requirements. Funding for any of a building department comes through the same fee process whether the jurisdiction is contracting out for service or not. So those requirements do not change. How we set our fees do not change. They're all set by state law, and we're required to run those through BCD already. So We believe that the passage of House Bill 2907 will benefit Oregon by increasing cities and counties' abilities to efficiently respond to builders' needs, increase the ability of certified inspectors, reducing inspection costs, and reducing wait times on construction projects, standardizing the rules for building inspectors, and reducing overall construction costs to consumers. House Bill 2907 is important to our work as a small company, and it provides in providing assistance to jurisdictions throughout the state, especially smaller cities and rural areas, as you've heard. We urge you to vote yes on the bill and provide a level playing field for all jurisdictions providing plumbing and electrical inspections for their citizens. To address the question that was raised a little earlier, all of our work is always done through every jurisdiction through a contract on it. It is never that you would be assigned a complete department unfed. We report directly to a city or county staff member always through those contracts. Often that's a public works director, a city manager, someone who has oversight of that program. So you never get to turn it directly over to us. We would never recommend that. We are simply adjunct staff, whether we're providing full building department services or whether we're just a fill-in work for the day. So that's the way that works. Those cities and our company are required to follow every law that is for every jurisdiction, no matter whether there's contract services or not. So that's the way that works. We just recommend that this bill be approved with a due pass recommendation, and certainly happy to answer any more questions you might have.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much. Up next, Jack Applegate. Good afternoon. If you just introduce yourself and before you give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Vice Chair Bynum, members of the committee, my name is Jack Applegate, and I want to thank you today for taking time to hear my testimony. More than the typical testimony, I'm going to read fairly quickly and get through my information for you, and if I don't look up as much, please don't take offense. I'm trying to speed up your time frame for you. My name is Jack Applegate of Eugene, Oregon. I'm manager of Northwest Code Professionals. I am a disabled veteran of Desert Storm and Desert Shield and former U.S. Navy CB who proudly defended our great state and our country and who today still defends those rights of citizens wanting to be treated fairly without bias on race, religion, identity, sexual orientation, or who we may freely choose to be employed by. As Oregonians, I feel we can all agree that citizens all deserve that basic fairness and equality under the laws written in this very building. I started in the construction industry in 1986. I am a third-generation building code official in Oregon and consider myself fortunate that knowledge was passed down to me from my grandfather and father, who both served Oregon citizens as licensed electricians, licensed electrical supervisors, and state-certified electrical inspectors. My elders worked with care, maintained technical skills, and provided customer service with pride for more than three decades in Oregon while protecting its citizens from electrical hazards. The retired electrical union members both had supervising electrical license numbers in the single digits, my father being license number 5, and passed down their knowledge and experience to hundreds of tradespeople throughout Oregon and inspectors, including myself.
Mr. Applegate?
Yes.
And we have your written testimony. If you could just summarize it, it's, you know, 3 pages long, rather than just reading the whole thing to us. Is that something you could accomplish, maybe?
I can. I can do that, Chair.
Thanks.
I guess really kind of blew the wind out of my sail here, but let me shift gears and go in.
I apologize. It's just sort of customary when somebody shows up with 4 pages and reads it to us. We'd rather just listen to you talk about the issue, and we will read your testimony later.
Thank you, Chair. So I guess first let me start out then, if I'm going to summarize, by Chair, addressing your question about administration. I think it was answered a little bit, but I don't think it was answered completely. In order for a third-party agency like ours, which I prefer to call a small business, in order for us to assume a program in the state of Oregon, we have to go through a very, very intense process with Oregon Building Codes Division, an application, showing we can afford to do it, show we're qualified to do it, showing that our operating plan is identical to the same requirements as any jurisdiction in the state of Oregon. That's, without a doubt, we have to do that. In addition to that, we have to sign a contract with Oregon Building Codes Division, just like every jurisdiction in the state of Oregon does, saying that we understand that Oregon Building Codes Division still has oversight. It's still their program. We're just running it for them. And so we never have anything but a standard administration, just like your typical building department in any state or county jurisdiction throughout the state of Oregon. And so I hope that answers that question. We fall under the same rules. If we're a bad actor, Building Codes Division can come in and punish us, our inspectors, our building official, the same way as any city or county inspector. They can do enforcement action. They can follow through with civil penalties. They can revoke licenses. I would say the only additional is we have another person to answer to, and that's the public. That's our city council. That's our county commission, who can fire us on a day's notice if we're not playing well with others. And especially when it comes to progress and customer service with contractors who want permits out the door, business owners who want their buildings built on time. If we're not following through and doing what we're supposed to do, we're punished at a technical level for not doing it right by BCD. We're punished at a customer service level by the public and by community city councils and county commissioners. And since you do have information that you can read, there is some statistics I would like to bring up and put some emphasis on it. Back in 2014, the International Code Council, who I serve on, I'm on the board of the International Code Council, who writes the building codes that Oregon eventually adopts and uses. And so I review every code change, every technical level change that comes through. I sit on a committee in a room a little bit bigger than this until people fall asleep. But the importance of the International Code Council is that it's an industry of experts from around the country who come together to write the code. And when they have concerns, I think we need to listen. And they did a survey in 2014 because they were really worried about the lack of inspectors, building officials, electrical inspectors around the country. When they did that, they received 3,850 responses from people from all 50 states in this country. And what we learned was it's a massive problem that we're about to face across this state. 85% of the respondents were over the age of 45. Not old, in my opinion. After this year, I'm 46. Only 3% were under age 35. 80% plan to retire within 15 years across this country. A full 30% will retire in just 5 years. Now, we've already gotten 2 years beyond that, and I'm seeing that across the state of Oregon right now. We have two electrical inspectors who are in their 70s who we beg and we promote good health and good eating because we're worried about that. And if 2907, if it doesn't pass, what we're going to see is a big problem for all the jurisdictions we currently serve. But in addition to that, every month I'm approached by a county or a city, some of them who have building codes divisions supporting them now, who can't keep up. And so they're asking us to come in and provide that help. And so if I have to take those technical level, A level is what they call it, the highest level of electrical and plumbing inspector in Oregon, and I have to send them out to a building to look at a little sink that they're changing out in one bathroom in a little tiny tea shop, when I could send the specialized plumbing inspector out there, it costs about 25% less to me, doesn't require me to raise permit fees in a city or charge more hourly when we're just doing partial work by contract. That's how critical this really becomes. The last thing of emphasis I would say is that in the last year, I've had those 9 people I couldn't hire because once they came to work for me from a city or a county, they could no longer use a certification they had been using every day. And that just doesn't make sense. It's not fair. And that's kind of the key reasoning behind this. I think there's some opposition that'll say, well, we're against private third party, period. And we understand that. They've been around for a long time, but so have we. Over 30 years in some jurisdictions, and people didn't even know we were a third party because we just do it the same way the city and counties do, and we hope a little bit better. The last thing I'd like to emphasize, and this is the speeded up version, I promise. I love to talk. I shouldn't have got off of the track here.
That was my mistake.
So there were some comments made in some of the testimony provided by opposition that talked about bad actors. I only know of one bad actor, third-party company, who was punished in the state of Oregon in the last 10 years. I know of several individual city or county inspectors or plans examiners who have gotten in trouble in that time period. So those same rules apply. The same punishment can apply. One of the other things they mentioned was cross-laminated timber and how highly technical building codes division inspectors and plans examiners are. They hired one of mine last year who was an engineer the year before last. I'm on the committee that's helping promote cross-laminated timber and making the codes work for Oregon so we can use it across the nation, which benefits Oregonians already. And so those are, you know, some of the things they're talking about. And building codes division employees was mentioned and how they're at 130 and they were once at 200. I just don't want us to get lost in the fog. That's not 200 inspectors. That is a ton of oversight, administrative staff, that we're all paying for with surcharges and our permits in each city. And in addition to that, Washington State is something I want you to look at. They have five state building codes division employees. And Washington State runs pretty smoothly and pretty fairly. Now, I like what building codes division does, but we don't need more inspectors and more plans examiners employed by building codes division. In addition to that, the rule already in place of law says building codes division is required to encourage local municipalities to assume their own building department program. And so what we're getting is a fight more against that than for that. But if you look at the rule of law, it says they're supposed to encourage that assumption of their own program. When they're ready, let's let them do it and do it well and supervise it themselves. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Up next, I have Ryan Tribbett, Ryan Krieg, and Daryl Fuller.
Ryan Tribbett here today on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association. I think the there's definitely some very different perspectives here on this topic. I know from the proponents paint a pretty rosy picture of the third-party programs. I know that for years my clients, 200 small businesses in the state, have a much different view of the jurisdictions that have third-party programs. They view it to be more expensive, lesser quality service, lesser availability of inspectors and plan review and all of the different functions. There is a sense amongst our contractors that these third-party groups sort of come in and assume the building codes departments of local jurisdictions when they see a big project coming and do it to come in and sort of swoop in and because they see dollar signs and will run a program in a local jurisdiction that previously had no program and then kick some money back to the local jurisdiction which we find is money that is fee revenue that is not being spent on the administration of a building department. We think is inappropriate and inefficient use of our fee resources. We have been lobbying another committee, the Ways and Means Committee, around a different solution to this problem. Back in the 2009 session when there was the recession, well, leading up to it, the Building Codes Division saw fewer permits being pulled. They cut back a lot of positions and themselves, and I think cut 30 or 40 positions that were a mix of plan reviewers and license enforcement. Inspectors were definitely a big component of what was cut. And when because they're part of the DCBS, General Fund Agency, when the legislature came in and cut and did away with all the vacant positions for general fund agencies, the Building Codes Division, even though it's a fee-based agency, was wrapped up in that, and you guys all cut the positions back. And so we believe that is what caused the shortage of inspectors, and we've been lobbying ever since. We lobbied against those being taken away. We lobbied to get them back. You guys gave us 8 of those positions back. We've been lobbying to get all 30 of them back. We're still doing that again this session. We think that's the right solution. We do believe there's a lack of accountability in the third-party programs as they exist now in terms of the multi-jurisdictional specialty inspector, that inspection program that's been created and in place for 3 years. We've been working with the Building Codes Division to try and do a review of that program. It was accepted by our clients with a bit of reluctance at the time, and we've been asking for an audit of that program and a review to see what's been working, what hasn't, and whether it warrants expansion or elimination. And I think it is premature to, in advance of that review, to go full bore expansion. We are opposed to this bill. Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian Krieg, and today I'm here representing the UA Plumbers in the state of Oregon, the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, and the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers, that is IBEW. I'm going to get to the core of this very quickly. The industry is still very uncertain about the use of multi-head inspectors in the field. We view this as an experiment still in progress. BCD came to industry a few years back pointing to the fact that we may need to try to come up with some new solutions to how we would be doing inspections in the state to try and give a little bit of alleviation to, you know, different places, particularly in rural Oregon and other areas. When it was put forward, we supported this with reluctance on it. We did so in that, and we supported it in that it was crafted to allow this for the state and local jurisdictions who actually conduct their own programs with their own actually public servants conducting the inspections on it as where we would start with this program. I think Mr. Tribbett hit on the point of we would like to take a look and review to see how well this is working, whether it should be expanded or contracted on that. And it's a little too early on that at this point to just open it on that. We don't have any data to see how well it's going on that. If this would have been open to all levels at the very start, I think our industry would have definitely opposed the bill back when it first came up several years ago on it. We would not have been in agreement at that time. So once again, my clients aren't comfortable with the current law. Hopefully they will get more comfortable with it, and if it does prove out, you know, with looking at it and doing some analysis on it, opening it further, it's something on the table, I'd say. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors in opposition to the bill. It was the 2013 session. The legislature passed House Bill 2698, gave the Building Codes Division the authority to experiment with the notion of taking a plumbing inspector and cross-training him to also be an electrical inspector, or to take an electrical inspector and cross-training them to be a plumbing inspector. So you're taking somebody that traditionally your inspector is somebody that had a long background in a particular trade or industry, but because of the need for inspectors, they thought, well, we'll just sort of cross-train them. And so when we talk about a multi-headed inspector, it's somebody who's inspecting on a part of the specialty code that maybe they don't have quite as much of experience as they do in what they primarily have done. And my colleagues were right. We were a little hesitant. We understand the need, especially in small and rural communities where it's difficult to have full-time inspectors in all of the disciplines there because of the volume of inspections. So we said, let's give it a try. But the notion that somebody who has been has experience in one discipline goes to a boot camp and all of a sudden they're very experienced in our industry, plumbing, for example, and to have somebody that their knowledge is book-based knowledge only is coming in and telling a plumbing contractor who's been in the business for 30 years, you're doing it wrong. As you can imagine, there's occasionally a little bit of friction there on who actually knows what the plumbing code says and what works and what doesn't work. So if we had a bill that passed in 2013, it became operative in 2014, Building Codes Division had to have time to spin up the program, do the training. We have, I think, less than 2 years of experience of these inspectors, these multi-prong inspectors, actually doing the work. We think it's a little premature to take that experience and then privatize it until we know whether the initial program has actually been a success or not. So we would encourage you to not pass the bill. We would encourage you to work with Building Codes Division, find out whether the multi-headed inspectors is actually working as effectively as we all hope that it does prior to using it as a privatization process. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony, and thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2907 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3203.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this is a measure Chief Sponsors Representative Clem. It requires contracting agency to determine whether a constructing a public improvement with own staff and equipment will result in the least cost to the agency. Draw your attention to the Dash 1 amendment that's before you, also submitted from Representative Clem. It replaces the original measure. Point out that it assigns duties to the Commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries instead of the Secretary of State. Make some clarifications and modifies civil remedies. Eliminates the emergency clause.
All right. I'm gonna probably have to limit the amount of time people have to testify on this. There's a tremendous amount of testimony, so hopefully people can try to keep their testimony down to 2 minutes. So let's start off with John Hickey, Melinda Daly, and John Kalkoven.
Thank you, Chair Holby, members of the committee. My name is John Hickey. I am Executive Director of the Asphalt Pavement Association of Oregon. I have a PowerPoint presentation, a bunch of slides. We're not going to cover all of them. I understand the time limitation.
Great.
To give you a little bit of background about myself, I'm a registered professional engineer in Massachusetts and Oregon. I've worked on the design, procurement, and construction of a lot of different construction projects. I'm also a lawyer. Practiced construction law in the Portland area in both Oregon and Washington for just under 10 years before I took the executive director job with the association. I represent contractors and local governments in all aspects of construction. I'm here today not only on behalf of the Pavement Association, but we have a coalition of a number of different associations, OCAPA, local chapter of the AGC. You get the idea. There's a lot of people in the construction industry concerned about this issue, which boils down to when may a public agency build a construction project with its own forces instead of hiring a contractor. And so I want to talk about the current law, what we see as the problems, our proposed solution, and we'll skip the examples. So current law, right, state policy for construction projects is least cost to the agency, least cost to the taxpayer. We're not talking about maintenance or emergency work. Public works crews can go out there, fix potholes, do sealing, maintain bridges, maintain culverts, not subject to the public contracting code. But when we get into larger improvement projects, public improvement construction projects, they're subject to the code, and that's the least cost policy. So every budget period, agencies have to send a list of the public improvement projects they want to build that budget period to BOLI. On that list, they have to state whether or not they intend to build those projects through a private contractor or with their own forces. And they also have to have a cost accounting system. So traditionally, most people think about major construction projects, you think about the least cost policy being fulfilled through competition, right? Contractors submit bids, and the public agency will select the lowest responsible bidder to construct that work. It's that competition that's typically fundamental to construction. And contractors wake up every day trying to figure out how to build quality work for less. So the issue becomes, well, what happens when you're not going to have that competition, and a public agency is just going to go and build a construction project with its own employees? Well, the law allows that. In Oregon today, if an agency wants to perform a public improvement project of more than $125,000 with its own forces, it has to show how that decision complies with the least cost policy. It essentially has to estimate. It has to estimate what it believes its cost would be to do the work and compare that to what it believes a construction company's cost would be to do the work. It also has to prepare plans and specifications and do some detail work on different aspects of the work and obviously keep an accounting of its cost. I refer to these requirements as the think before you spend requirements. They can only do the major construction projects if they've thought it through and have ensured that they're not wasting public money and spending more than they have to on the work. Right? But what we've seen over the years, we've essentially seen three groups of agencies. There are a lot of agencies that comply with the law. We have no problem with that. They do the cost analysis if they want to do the major work, but they typically focus their employees on maintenance work, which we believe there is plenty to do. Then there are agencies who say they don't really know how to comply with the law. They don't know how to do the construction cost estimating. And we sort of think, if you don't know how to do construction cost estimating, maybe you shouldn't be doing construction. And then there's this third category of agencies where we don't believe they're complying in good faith with the law. When we look at their cost analyses, we see equipment costs at really low numbers that are just, or zero. They'll say, we don't have any equipment costs because we already own the equipment. It might be a $500,000 piece of equipment, but because we already own it, they'll put zero in their cost analysis, and it becomes really hard to compete if somebody doesn't have equipment cost. Another issue that we have with the statute is it becomes hard to make apples to apples comparisons between private contractors and public agencies for a few different reasons. I'll just hit on a couple of them. Contractors do have independent quality control, where the owner is checking the quality of the work. When the agency's doing its own work, the agency's essentially the judge and jury of its own work. In addition to that, contractors provide warranties that don't apply for public entities doing it. And there are other sort of non-apples-to-apples type issues that we see with the statute.
Yeah. If you could kind of wrap up your testimony, that would be great.
The biggest problem we see is that the remedies are ineffective. When we see a violation, we got to sue in court. That's the only remedy right now under the statute. Lawsuits, ineffective way to address this issue, and it pits a contractor against its primary customers. Right? And so what we want to do is add clarity on how to do that cost analysis and put enforcement with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Have an easy administrative process that would handle it so we don't have to go through a lawsuit. And some of the concerns that have been raised by some of the entities that we've tried to address, this will be my last slide, is not have prevailing wages part of it. Whatever their real employee costs are, that's what it would be. ODOT raised that concern, and we said, sure, that's fine. Whatever your real costs are, just put it in the analysis. Confirm that chip seals and other road maintenance type work would not be subject to the law, which we don't have a problem with, but we do think that paving at more than $125,000 should be subject to the think before you spend principle. And they also were concerned about a first offense resulting in a big formal process. And so we put a provision in that said on a first offense, Bully would just provide a warning letter. Just say, hey, if you keep offending this law, we're going to continue with a more formal process. Second offense, Bully would attempt to negotiate a settlement where they would agree in writing to comply with the law. And only beyond that would there be a formal hearing process. And we also put reasonable time limits on enforcement. So with that, I'll end my portion of this discussion.
Yeah, and I think we have your full set of slides in OLIS, do we not, Jan? So I appreciate your testimony. It's a good overview. Thank you.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I'm Melinda Daly with I'm the executive director of the Northwest Utility Contractors Association, here in full support of this bill, and I hope you take it into consideration. I'm going to defer my testimony time to Mr. Cal Coben, who will share on our behalf.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Cal Coben. I own Titan Utilities, a construction firm based in Beaverton. I do underground sewer and water public works jobs. I am also a current board member and past president of NUCA. NUCA has spent a number of years looking at this. Couple of key points. Starting in 2007, we went to Bowley. We got all the forms that the public agencies are supposed to be turning in. We've charted it. We've updated it. Several very apparent trends. A lot of public agencies were not turning in all the Bowley forms. Secondly, the amount of work that they are doing themselves has tripled in the last 10 years. Thirdly, in meetings with various public agencies, we have never found one public agency that has what we consider to be true, accurate internal costing. They do not know their cost. When they give us their data, it is always way below market. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate you cutting it a little bit short, but I think you did a good job of portraying what the issue is.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Up next, I'm going to have Mike Stuber, Ty Kobach, and Michael Magee.
Would you make up your mind?
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. My name is Mike Stuber. I'm the director of the Portland Water Bureau. I am joined at the table by Mr. Kobach, who runs our construction and maintenance department, and Mike McGee on my left, who is with Portland Bureau of Transportation. Lots of talk today about asphalt. I'm not talking about asphalt. I'm talking about a biggest public health system in the state outside of OHSU, and that is the Portland water system. The problems are somewhat similar for the other agencies that are involved in this. The Portland Water Bureau opposes HB 3203. As proposed, this bill creates unnecessary obstacles to our ability to effectively build, maintain, and manage our water system and uphold our responsibility to protect public health and safety. Basically, as a public health agency, when mains break and so on, we have to act. And this modified bill is even more complicated than the last one. You can do the 125K analysis, but I'll tell you the Portland Water Bureau treats it as a cap. We got sued a few years ago over it. We won. We spent weeks, months in court, and we can't get anything done when we do that. So we treat it as a de facto cap. The health and safety of a million people served by our drinking water each day depends on the continued expertise of our crews who are familiar with our complex water system and are certified to operate it. You have to be certified to operate a water system in the state of Oregon. And upon our ability to respond to events and emergencies where public health and safety are at risk. Ty's crews fixed 92 main breaks in the cold weather fund we had in Portland in January and early February. All kinds of weather, all hours of the day, down in a muddy hole freezing. Additionally, we need to be prepared to be seismically responsive. One of our big concerns is resilience for the seismic system. And if we do have an earthquake, our crews need to be trained and capable of laying pipe. That's basically what we're talking about. Unfortunately, this bill does not recognize the urgency of our public health work. It fails to address fundamental differences between excavation work associated with making large repairs to water systems, such as water quality events or seismic emergencies, and paving and other transportation-related work. They are not synonymous and should not be treated as such. On a cost basis, public works projects that involve excavation are inherently impacted by a cap more due to the higher costs of excavation. By keeping the cap low, this hasn't been changed since 1997. You all know the effects of inflation. Since 1997, that's almost 20 years to the date, the cap is too low. And what that does is it doesn't allow us to optimize the point where our crews are more efficient. They are more efficient at pipe lengths to, say, 1,000 to 2,000 feet. Beyond that, it is more efficient to do by contract. We haven't tripled our in-house work. We stay a pretty steady $5 million a year. Right now, today, I have $50 million annual budget, and we have $172 million under contract work. Forcing us to contract small jobs increases the project's cost. It delays completion of the project. It diminishes our ability to respond quickly in emergencies. It harms building the capacity of our labor force to respond to emergencies, and it ignores the efficiency of the in-house labor force. We run our own BOLI certified apprentice program, and our crews are trained to do exactly what they do, and the crew leaders are all certified to operate a water system. The Water Bureau agrees with the Portland Bureau of Transportation, Bureau of Environmental Services, the Eugene Water and Electric Board, and others that you're going to hear from today, and also our organized workforce, AFSCME and PTE Local 17, that the cap needs to be increased because we try and operate under the cap. We also request that an index to inflation or other escalator be established. We don't want to have to keep coming back here and being caught up in the transportation efforts.
Thank you. I appreciate
thank you
your
very much.
Testimony. Quick question from Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, you referenced 92 main breaks. Those sound like individual instances where something needs to be maintained or fixed. I have a hard time believing that each one of those is 125.
Oh, they're not.
Right, so
they're not.
That wouldn't apply to this legislation, correct?
No, it shouldn't. Although, if you got a big enough job, here's the challenge that we face. In 1997, when this number was upped, we could lay about 8 blocks of pipe. Now, because of the effects of inflation, we're down to a block. It depends totally on what's actually broken.
So, quick follow-up to that. So my point is, though, is that I don't want there to be a muddying of the waters, though, as we're listening to this legislation, because when we're talking about maintenance and emergency response and whatnot, I feel like that's giving people the opinion that somehow this is going to take that control away from you, and I'm not really seeing how that would be under this bill.
Chair Hovey, Representative Hurd, Ty Kovach, Director of Maintenance and Construction for the Portland Water Bureau. I think the broader point that Director Stewart was making is we're staffed up to be able to respond to system issues that occur in a system that has 2,500 miles of pipe in it and 40,000 valves and 16,000 hydrants. So we have a staff that's dedicated to that on a reactive basis. When we're not doing that, we have a host of work that we could be doing to improve the system. Some of that work is in excess of the $125,000 cap, but we don't do that work because we treat the rule as a cap. There's also a buffer between that $125,000 cap and where we start contracting it out, because the contracting community isn't as interested in some of that lower dollar threshold kind of work. And so ultimately, all we're asking for is some recognition of inflation in the universe. We're not trying to expand dramatically the work that we do in-house. We want to be able to maintain a steady amount of work that helps our crews maintain their experience and their expertise, so that if we have big events like 92 main breaks or an earthquake, we're able to quickly get in and respond without a 5 to 6 month contracting process that goes along with contracting that work out. And as he said, we have about $6 million in in-house work that we do, and 30 to 50 in mains work that we farm out, and hundreds of millions in other work that we have contracted out. So we're really at the margins, and we're asking for an increase to that very small margin that we're already at.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Michael McGee with the Transportation Bureau, so I have a direct connection with the transportation. So I'll just augment what's been said. Is in the city of Portland, the $125,000 cap may have seemed like a lot of money, but we have to grind and then repave on top of that. That, and we do full cost accounting. We include all of those costs and those things. And we've shared this information with NUCA and other parties that are interested in this bill. So we want to be transparent. We will continue to be transparent. But for us, in a downtown environment, it's about 3 blocks that we have the $125,000 limit. And then we're in this realm of saying we have to go into analysis, put ourselves in perspective that we may be called out, has to be dragged into more discussions about it. And so that's why it becomes an essential cap for us. So we track it. In the way they've drafted this language, it takes away the flexibility that we need. And you all know the conditions of our roadways. So we're asking you to understand it. Just like they talked to the Water Bureau, we have the exact same needs, but on the surface, grinding an inland roadway is an effective treatment for us. We're not playing games here. We're trying to get good work done efficiently with the resources that we have. Each agency is different. We have 4,800 lane miles of roadway in the city of Portland. That's from here to Tokyo or here to London. And for us to be able to perform effectively, it's a billion-dollar asset that we're trying to maintain on an annual basis. We only do self-performed. We have not grown our staff. We're just operating the same level that we have been for years. So the $125,000 cap that they've imposed on a transportation element is a real issue for us. And that's why we're asking you to reconsider it. The last thing I will say is that the language, when you read it, and we've testified this, it's confusing when they go back and forth where is it a maintenance? Is it exempt? Is it now a public improvement? Is it 125? Is it the same road? I won't go into the details, but as a practitioner and the person I have to administer this, the way it's written, it's unclear to me how I can administer our program without falling into some sort of where I'm not in compliance. And we want to comply with the laws.
Thank you. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make a comment and ask if we could schedule an outside meeting. I was a water main break victim in December. We lost over, $16,000-$20,000, and it was PBOT, it was ODOT, it was Northwest Natural and the Water Bureau all out there trying to get the water main break at in Foster, 82nd and Foster, in Portland, sorry. And so I think it's important for you all to be able to respond very quickly. It still took 3 days for that water main break to be fixed, but the businesses really need to be, the cities, to be very nimble in getting businesses back up and running and getting homes back up and running. So not saying I'm in support or opposition, but I recognize that as a grave business need. So,
thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much.
Chair Holby, committee, thank you very much.
Up next, Mike Eliason, John Vile, and Chris Urban.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be exceedingly brief and defer most of my time to Mr. Vile to my right. While we still oppose the bill, both at the base bill and the Dash 1 amendment, we have had several meetings with the Contractors Coalition and believe we are making some progress and do appreciate a few of the changes that have gone into the Dash 1 amendment. We still have a fair number of issues with the bill, which Mr. Vile will touch on, but I remain confident that by the end of the session there's a good middle ground and potential compromises to be had. With that, I'll defer to Mr. Vile.
Chair Holby and members of the committee, my name is John Vile, and I'm the Public Works Director for Jackson County, and I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Counties. The House Bill 3203 clearly is addressing a law that's frequently called the least cost law, and it's a law that, as far as public policy, the Association of Oregon Counties completely agrees with. The public and the taxpayers should have projects delivered for the least cost. We appreciate the associations working with us. The Dash 1 amendments did address many of the concerns that we did have with the bill, but we do have several items that we still remain very concerned about, and I will touch on three of those. The first one is the law defines what a public improvement is, and a public improvement in the current law is defined as anything that costs over $125,000. And it includes a provision if you have 2 inches or more of a asphalt being laid. What the Dash 1 amendments include is a change from 125 and 2 inches of asphalt to an or. By changing that simple and to an or, basically any time you pave more than 2 inches, it's automatically considered a public improvement. So if the city of Portland wanted to go pave a half a block, a very short distance, if they're putting down more than 2 inches, it's considered a public improvement and all the provisions of this law apply. We think that's an overreach. We think the and should stay and should not be changed to an or. The writers did attempt to address this and what they call maintenance resurfacing, but maintenance resurfacing is not defined in the law, and the bottom line is the public improvement is still defined as an or, 125 or anything over 2 inches. The second item has been addressed here already, and it's the $125,000 limit. That limit was established in 1997, and at that time the legislature felt like that was a good threshold to define what a public improvement is. But since 97, things have changed. I started in the maintenance field in 1997. When I started, I could buy asphalt oil for $100 a ton. We just opened bids 2 weeks ago in Jackson County, and I was thrilled to get bids where I'm paying $465 a ton. And things have went up almost five times. Similarly, when I started, we could buy hot mix asphalt for less than $20 a ton. Right now I'm paying $51, and there's a lot of people that are very jealous of me that we're getting it for that cheap. Similar increases have been seen in labor, rock, concrete, and other things. And I think the $125,000 limit needs to be addressed. It's been in place for 20 years now. And if it was good policy in 97 to have a cap that high, I think looking at it now is reasonable. The last item I would touch on is within the Dash 1 Amendment bill, there's three pages that cover enforcement. It includes a continuing series of escalations of how enforcement can be completed if a local government is in violation of the bill or of the law. The concern is the only people that can bring a complaint to Boley is the contracting community, and the public can't even do it. Only the contractors, those that benefit from the law, are the only ones that can bring a complaint. We think that's poor public policy, and we would ask that that be addressed. As Mr. Eliason noted, we have been working with the Trade Association on this law. We are pleased that several changes have been made, and we would look forward to continuing to work with them. We think the least cost law is a good law, and we think that changes hopefully could be made to the bill to make it acceptable, but as currently written, we are very concerned about the heavy-handed approach that it has on local government. And with that, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Chris Irvin. I'm a senior engineer at the Eugene Water and Electric Board.
Could you move the mic just a little bit closer?
Sorry. EWEB is Oregon's largest customer-owned utility and provides more than 180,000 people with drinking water. EWEB currently has a water operations staff of 83 personnel, 23 of whom are dedicated to the maintenance and construction of the water distribution system. These personnel are vital to fulfilling our mission of providing clean, safe drinking water. House Bill 3203 could hinder EWEB's ability to maintain these resources so critical to protecting our customers' health. EWEB maintains over 775 miles of distribution pipeline as an average of 42 years old. These pipelines break on average 87 times per year. This often results in crews working long shifts through the night to restore water service. It is crucial for our utility to maintain a basic level of staffing, competency, equipment, and expertise within the ranks of our water operations division. This is accomplished by utilizing our crews strategically to replace, retrofit, and upgrade our system as they are available. A typical job for our construction crew is about 1,000 feet long at a cost of approximately $225,000. The proposed limit of $125,000 could make it difficult to replace even one single block of water main in our system without going through this. These small jobs are much more efficiently and expediently handled using in-house forces rather than relying on a contractor. Through continuing improvements and increased efficiencies, our recent analysis have shown that we are able to perform work using our own crews at a cost comparable to hiring a contractor. In interest of our ratepayers, EWEB strives to construct improvements using the least cost method possible. However, we are here first and foremost to protect the public's health. Please consider impacts this bill would have on our utility's ability to fulfill our core mission. We urge you to consider raising the limit where a least cost analysis is required to at least $275,000 so EWEB can continue to perform routine maintenance and small improvements without unnecessarily burdensome regulations. We also request that this value be increased annually by the CPI to ensure it remains reasonable over time. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. Mr. File, I got to thinking after I heard Portland water talk. Are not emergencies excluded from this?
I think we're trying to address the basic, having the necessary people, training, equipment, and part of that is, our it goes up and down, right? With sometimes there's a whole bunch of breaks and you have to address it, like the cold weather.
Sure.
And sometimes there's nothing, so we need to be able to have, a basic baseline of work for crews to do when they're not repairing stuff. And so this $125,000 is so low that they can't even do a one-block job. So if they're not able to do some basic work in between the times when they're really needed, it really hamstrings the ability to, basically it could reduce the amount of forces so that in an emergency, there wouldn't be enough people.
Mr. Chair, if I could. So you're saying that you do, there is an emergency exemption, but the problem is how do you maintain adequate staff when there's not an emergency?
You still have to have excavators, dump trucks, all this equipment, and what do they do most of the time? I mean, they can't just sit around, so. And $125,000 doesn't buy a lot of work these days, so.
I wish it did.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony. I'm going to have up Todd Baker, Rick Angstrom, and Paloma Sparks. Thank you. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Holby, Vice Chair Bynum, committee. My name is Todd Baker. I'm president of Baker Rock Resources in Beaverton, Oregon. Third generation. I think part of the problem with this law is some agencies do a really good job of abiding by the existing laws. Some agencies basically flaunt it in your face. I've been in this a long time. The problem is it doesn't work for me to go complain against my customer. I did that once. I'll never do it again. I went to the public works director, and he said, "Do you change the light bulbs in your? Do you hire someone to change the light bulbs in your house?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, that's how we view paving streets in our city." And yeah, it's hard to be a paving contractor in Oregon because the season's so long. So you have to buy this equipment and utilize it. This particular city bought a brand new paver to pave 20,000 tons. I pave about 80,000 a year and have a hard time justifying owning that piece of equipment. So I think, some of the cities do a really good job, I think. They do the analysis. And there's been times where they can do it cheaper than a contractor could do it. But other times, they don't. They will take a project that you would normally bid out, and they will bid out certain other items, and then they'll keep other items for themselves. I've witnessed them paving two back-to-back lifts, 2 inches, you know, and it's way over. And this is a much smaller city that I know did not do the analysis that they're required to do. One of the other things, The biggest issue is, the other thing I would say is, so the interesting thing for me is I also supply asphalt. So the cities and the counties buy the material from me. I actually make more money in that way. The reason I protested this in the very beginning is because I was a resident of the city that was buying the machine, and they're not spending my tax dollars wisely. So it costs me money. It cost me money, my company money, to testify against them, but then it cost me my company money because they weren't happy that I testified against them. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I have an interesting role in this issue because I provide the materials, whether it's asphalt, concrete, or aggregates to either side, whether it's the public works doing it or the private sector doing it. And so I have a little bit of a unique perspective of trying to find the right balance between all of this. I would like to say, before I make any further comment, that we really appreciate AOC and ODOT have really sat down and worked hard with us on coming up with some language. The last draft actually had a couple of errors in it, like the and or thing. We just got rid of the whole 2-inch thing and left it at a cap of 125. That didn't come out in the amendment. So there are some things that created some confusion the way they came out. So what I'm saying is a little bit of a work in progress. We're trying to get the language down to where everybody would agree to. But there's a couple of points I think are important to make. One of them is emergencies are exempt in law already. If there's a main break, a water main break, the city of Portland can rush right out and do it. They don't have to contract out. They don't have to contract it out. They already have that ability. The other thing is they talk about this not being that they talk about it being a cap. The law does not work that way. The law works that they can do, local governments can do any project they want without accounting to all of us and you up to 125. After 125, we ask them to sharpen their pencils and have some daylight on what they're doing so we know how they're spending their dollars, so there's transparency in what they're doing. And those that say they're treating it as a functional cap are kind of saying to you that they don't want you to see necessarily what they're doing and how it's being accounted for. We're troubled by that. The other thing is, I think it's important to know what the other states around us are doing. In Idaho, it's an absolute cap at 50,000. In California, with detail and color, it's 45,000. In Washington, depending on the size of the city, it's 65 or 95,000. So at 125, we're already pretty high up. On OLIS, there's a lot of examples that we put in, and I'm not going to go over those, but I think you should review what we see as some of the trouble that we have seen that needs to be, you know, just better thought out. And you can go through the examples on OLIS that we've cited. I've seen some of them myself personally, and I think, you know, this bill fixes it. The last thing I want to say, just on the, kind of the follow-up, is 125, as we've been talking to our members and we've been in these groups talking about it, most of the jobs actually fall under 125, but right around 125 is where most of the county and city jobs are for paving. If you move it up, then what you're saying is we're going to let them do it all and not send it out to the private sector. So last point. The policy in this statute, it creates a preference for the private sector doing the work. But it acknowledges that the local governments have to have, because they have to do maintenance all year long, especially during the winter. Great example is this last winter. They have to have staff to keep going through the summer months because their workload really expands, and we don't do a lot of that winter maintenance program. So there's a balance that the legislature in the past has found on that particular piece. The other thing that's important about what the statute does is it puts the agencies in charge of what the least cost project is. We don't get to decide that. The only limitation to them is that they have to daylight it after 125. It's got to be transparent so we know how those dollars are being spent for our infrastructure, for our transportation, for our city, our water and sewer lines. And so my point is there are some points here that are clashing, and we need to work through those. And I think we've made a great progress. We need a little more time, be straight with the chair. And a couple of them is we still are working on is what that definition of maintenance is versus a capital improvement and what that cap should fairly be. So that they can accomplish their goals, and we still make a preference so the work goes out to Oregon labor forces and our Oregon businesses. So with that, I'm going to conclude my testimony. Hope that was helpful. I meant it to be more helpful than you know, just driving in one necessarily particular direction. So thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We have been working with the proponents of the bill for, my entire time with the Bureau, so about 3 years. You'll notice that in ORS 279C305, there is already a requirement that governments that want to self-perform have to file with BOLI. That happens inconsistently. And, you know, when the utility contractors first came to us and pointed this out, you know, we said, you know, there's not a lot of enforcement. There's not a lot we can do about that. I think this bill is an attempt to address that particular problem. We are happy to continue to work on this effort with the proponents, and we just support the effort.
Thank you. I hope you're willing to work with the opponents as well.
Also the opponents.
Thank you. Up next, Tracy Rutten, Tim Gross, I think, and Suzanne DiLorenzo.
Good Good afternoon, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. For the record, Tracy Rutten, League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in opposition to House Bill 3203 and the -1 Amendment. I'm going to be very brief and defer my time to our technical experts that we've brought forward today. There are a few comments that I do want to make, and again, to touch on that issue of the importance of an and versus an or. We see that as a significant change in the law. Essentially, when you change that and provision to the or provision, what you've done is obliterate the threshold, in our opinion. So when our folks need to do water, sewer work, they need to dig down to a line, you're going to disturb more than 2 inches of pavement. So right now, what it says is 125,000 and 2 inches. The bill would indicate or. And so any disturbance of 2 inches or resurfacing that results as you've disturbed 2 inches is now a public improvement contract. So that is one issue I want to clarify. I also want to note that this applies to far more than road work. It's public improvement projects generally. So that is any construction, reconstruction, major renovation of real property. And so it's a very broad change. We see there being a lot of additional administrative burden associated with the bill's requirements. And with that, I will defer my time to the others and happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Suzanne DiLorenzo, and I'm the chair of the Oregon Water Utilities Council. The Oregon Water Utility Council is a committee of the Pacific Northwest section of the American Water Works Association. OWOC membership is made up of cities, special districts, and public utility districts, and our members collectively supply domestic water to over 75% of the population of Oregon. Our mission is to ensure that our communities are provided with high-quality, safe, reliable drinking water at a great price and sufficient qualities to support community growth. Now, one of our concerns is that this bill doesn't really take into account the nuances of maintaining underground infrastructure. You know, it's easy to forget about. You go home, you turn on the faucet, it's there, you fill up your pots. You flush the toilet, it goes down. You don't think about the vast underground infrastructure that we maintain to make that happen. Now, addressing new infrastructure needs as well as maintaining and repairing aging infrastructure is key to meeting municipal water needs now and into the future. In a time when aging water infrastructure has resulted in an estimated $5.6 billion in funding needs for drinking water alone in the state of Oregon, amendments to House Bill 3203 threaten to impose a barrier to quickly and efficiently address infrastructure improvements and repairs. Our members have abided by the existing threshold of $125,000 for decades. However, the bill proposes a change that could potentially eliminate the current threshold if 2 or more inches of pavement needs to be resurfaced. Most work performed by a utility in the distribution system requires opening the right-of-way and resurfacing at more than 2 inches. Section 1, subsection 6A of House Bill 3203 paves the way for any public improvement performed on water lines, mains, and even some meters to be subject to requirements of the bill at least cost analysis. Essentially, what the -1 amendment in Section 16A would require is that utilities demonstrate least cost any time an organization needs to dig to a water line, regardless of cost. So in this scenario, a minor water leak, not an emergency, that can quickly and efficiently be repaired could take weeks. And so we heard that mantra of think before you spend, but unfortunately, this puts us in a position where we have to spend while we think and then go out and fix the problem. So this will become a new burden on utilities and subsequently their ratepayers by increasing administrative costs and the costs on public improvements. It also impacts essential services, including the public health and safety, for which OWOC members are responsible by undercutting the utility's ability to deliver improvements in a timely and cost-effective manner and delaying repairs. If the bill moves forward, changes need to be made to ensure that drinking water utilities and water providers are not hindered in their mission to provide reliable drinking water. The following changes need to be considered. The first, as Tracy stated, the issue with the at a depth of 2 or more inches. So the removal of at a depth of 2 or more inches from Section 1, subsection 6A would be necessary, or as an alternative, restoring the and in that section. Lastly, including an exclusion for routine maintenance, which hasn't really been fully defined, and repair projects to prevent the risk that such projects won't be interpreted as being covered under the procedures. So as public utilities, It's our duty to provide the public with the best value and services to support our communities, and we urge you to take this under consideration as you move forward.
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tim Gross. I'm the Director of Public Works and the City Engineer with the City of Newport. Newport is a town of about 10,000 people located on the Central Oregon coast, and I think it's probably a fairly good representative of small communities in Oregon. And we have the unfortunate distinction of being example number one in the presentation that you had seen earlier. I think that presentation was made in the fall, and you have a copy of that as well. And I think there's some clarifications that need to be made as far as that presentation, and it will lead into a couple points that I have. That particular project that you saw on there was actually a project of about $330,000 in value. $323,000 of that was contracted out to a local asphalt company and to a local concrete company. The work that you actually saw in the photographs was actually completed by one of the local contractors. And the city, as a matter of practice for large projects like this, will often go out and upgrade meters. In this particular instance, the road was a gravel road being paved as a paved road, and it was widened a little bit, so we had to move our water meters out. We didn't know how the storm drainage worked in this area. This road was platted in the late 1800s, much older than anybody I have in my staff, and we had to figure out how the storm drain worked, and so we dug out the ditches where the curbs were. We replaced a couple catch basins. We prepped the way for the concrete contractor to come in, turned it over to the contractors to do their work. And so the project was misrepresented that the city completed the job on our own. And we acted in good faith, understanding that as long as we're not doing work in excess of $125,000, it's not necessary for the city to account for a cost estimate up front to determine how much work we're actually doing. And we weren't even within the ballpark. And so we'd received a public records request asking for plans and specifications on that work that we had done and our cost estimates. And the list that was presented to Boley showing Case Street on that list, well, none of those things existed. And so it's a matter of policy typically with most organizations that you don't infer what somebody's looking for, but you really reply with what they actually asked for. And so we gave them no information and told them that we didn't have that information because it was part of a much larger project. My point on this is that normally, this would not be a bill that would really impact a small community. I don't have the resources to do projects of $125,000. You know, we barely can keep our infrastructure together as it is. And yet, still, I'm here presenting before you today because our city was lifted up as an example of a city doing public contracting. And the reason for that was because it was brought forward by a local contractor who had a beef with our community. And I've been doing contracting for about 25 years in the public sector, and some relationships with contractors go well. And some don't. And unfortunately, this bill proposes to allow the contractors to be the very agents to enforce this bill. And the provisions of that actually state that Boley, on the second infraction, will force the agency into an agreement with the contractor. And in the effort of least cost contracting, that really makes little sense to me. I don't quite understand the reasoning why we would have the organizations that are actually benefiting from this bill being the very agents to enforce it. I had just a couple other issues that I wanted to raise. Most of my other points have been covered, and one is that I think the Contractors Associations is looking to level the playing field between public agencies and private contractors, and yet they want within this proposed legislation to have the cities account for costs that we don't actually incur. And what I mean by that is they talk about warranties that contractors are required to provide but cities are not, or bonds or insurance that they're required to provide but the cities don't have to. And the reason that those things are out there is because we do get poor quality of work from contractors, and we are required to have them come back and do repairs from time to time. And we don't have the teeth to do that without those documents. But when we're doing work on our own for our own infrastructure that we have to maintain, we don't need those guarantees that they're going to be repaired because we do that work. We're the ones at 2 o'clock in the morning fixing something that was done poorly. And so really, those are really the points that I have. I'd be happy to open up for any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to present. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate you being here and providing us your testimony. I apologize. I'm going to have to carry over House Bill 3189. I am going to run out of time, but we will carry it over. So I do apologize for that. I am going to proceed to finish up the testimony on this bill, though, and hopefully have a few minutes left. So up next, Mark Landauer, Brian Stahl. Joe Basler. And if you could be really concise, I think we've really covered this pretty well. So thank you for making your statements. Indeed. 20 seconds or less.
Okay. 20 seconds.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark Landauer. I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Much has been covered already. We oppose the Dash 1 Amendment. Two things I'd just simply like to emphasize, the and or that has been previously mentioned. Obviously, that removes the monetary cap on utility work. The other thing that I'd mention briefly is the fact that under the amendment, road maintenance is really well defined, whereas utility work is not. Utility maintenance is in no way, shape, or form defined under the bill. We think that that would be a big improvement. I've asked Mr. Stahl with Rockwood PUD to, who's our expert on this, and take it over, please.
Big shoes trying to keep me to 20 seconds, Mr. Chair, but I'll do it, give it my best shot. Chair Holby, Vice Chairs Bynum, Barreto, and members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. For the record, my name is Brian Stahl. I'm the general manager of Rockwood Water PUD. We're a medium-sized utility that operates in the metro area between the cities of Portland and Gresham. And I'm here, obviously, with Mark to voice opposition to 3201-1. If the intent of this bill is to ensure the maximum benefit and biggest rate of return to ratepayers in project construction, we are in total agreement that utilities should be operated under the philosophy and practice of best return on investment for the public. Public utilities are operated under the direction of elected boards answerable to the public. Any person who feels a utility is not operated equitably and with maximum benefit to ratepayers has the ability, and there is a public process before an elected body to voice concerns related to operating at least cost. Public utilities, they operate 24/7, 365 days a year. You heard the testimony on the criticality of being sure that our workforces are the best trained, most efficient that we can possibly have. And this effort is even recognized in the Oregon Resiliency Plan that, you know, basically states knowledge and ability is going to be critical to the state in any event. If the legislation seeks redress for a global problem, then I'd suggest the following. You've heard the cap of 125. The criteria that, you know, we heard apples to apples. I'm all for apples to apples comparisons when we're comparing public work to private contractors. But we also need to take a look at that for the listing for intent and purpose. For examples, public agencies, we own our work forever, well beyond a warranty, a one-year or two-year warranty. We require less engineering. Our crews are trained to install based on the criteria and the standards that are being applied by the agency. And failing that are subject to discipline. So we have a process to be sure that they are constructing things appropriately. There's no margin for profit built into the pricing. There's no need for immediate rates of return or depreciation for our equipment. Travel to any public agency, and we'll run that equipment until the wheels fall off. Because when we get a piece of equipment, we value it, and we run it to the maximum benefit of the public. You have a number of items in there. The inches of asphalt were covered. One of the things I would mention is the provision of lists to the agencies. It really needs to recognize the timing of project budgeting and the funding long leads. for a municipality, a public agency that is under a one-year fiscal period of time. These lists are generated at least 18 months prior to the end of that fiscal year. If you're operating under a biennium, it's even longer. We all know lists and priorities change, and that needs to be recognized. If the intent of this bill is to correct behavior of a few, then we are in agreement that there should be accountability and due process identified if the current language of the law doesn't accommodate that. However, we should not be in the business of legislating behavior merely to address the behaviors of some individuals who don't get it. We should ascribe to the Management 101 approach, where those with behavioral needs that need to be changed are counseled before discipline. Public agencies have built strong relationships with contractors who provide valuable service. Public agencies understand their capacities. They do not have anything in excess and are accountable to their elected boards and their ratepayers for providing excellent and efficient service at the most cost-effective price for the community. We take pride in that service and responsibility, and that service requires training and employing the best. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. And go ahead. Now you have 2 seconds.
Yes, sir. Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. I just want to echo everything that was said by the City of Portland. I so rarely get to agree with our employer, the City of Portland, but we do here.
We
oppose this bill. One of the major we represent the workers at the Water Bureau, and one of the major frustrations I've had with working with them and hearing from them is that there's so much more they could be doing, and they're stopped from doing it because of this is ostensibly a cap. So we would love to, if we can figure out a way to work out an increase in the cap, then maybe we can get there on this bill, but we are right now opposed. So thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. I know Elliot Levin has also signed up, and Bill Kirby. I don't know if you have anything to add. If you wish to add something, you're certainly welcome for your 2 seconds as well. I apologize for cutting you short.
I will be brief, Chair Hulby.
I'm really serious. You have less than a minute.
Ditto on everything every public agency said, and know that we are audited by an outside auditor. Every year they have to look at 279C. And see whether we comply in terms of how we do cost accounting. And we have clean audits every year, and I suspect Newport does too.
Thank you.
Chair Hulby, members of the committee, PT Local 17 represents the engineering and technical staff at the City of Portland. My name is Elliot Levin, for the record. This staff is responsible for project management, right? So we oversee these contracts. And I just brought a prop. This is a bid book for a contract. This is generally the same size for any contract. So what I want to talk about that hadn't been covered yet today is just the issue of transaction costs, which is, you know, depending on the size of the contract, this book still has to be done. So when we have very small contracts, those transaction costs become a larger and larger percentage of those contracts. This is inefficient. This is why we've seen that $125,000 cap be a larger and larger problem for our efficiency. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate your testimony and hope that, if parties are willing, that they work on this a little bit more and see if there can be a closer agreement on the outstanding issues, and I'll be listening. Thank you very much for that. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3203. We will carry over House Bill 3189 to Monday. We may repost that additionally. And also, what else do we have, Jan? We will carry over the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2265 to Monday as well. I apologize. So with that, we will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. The House Committee on Business and Labor.